Portions of this program may be pre-recorded.
Is sponsored.
The opinions and statements made by the host and the guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, Stephen K. Bannon. Stephen Bannon, as you know, the senior strategist to the President of the United States. He was a chairman of the Trump campaign in 2016, engineered the victory. He's also the host of the hottest radio show in the world. Forget the U.S., the world, and that's War Room Pandemic, heard on the John Fredericks Radio Network, 10 to noon, Monday to Saturday, also in Hong Kong. And it's streamed all over the world. Australia, I get calls from Australia, New Zealand, you name it. People listen to it all over the world. And he is with us now, Steve Bannon. Welcome.
Well, John, thank you. And I want to thank you for, because of the being co-producer on the show and the our lead distributor, the Chinese Communist Party, as you know, for the last 7 days is on their national TV and all their national media outlets. Their papers have named me public enemy number one of the Chinese Communist Party. So I want to thank you for giving us the platform to do that, that we know that we're getting, that we're connecting with the right people since we've got the Chinese Communist Party at war with us now.
Steve, the truth will set you free, and that's what you're doing.
I just want to say the truth. That's why I think your show's so big, and you know the media all over the world. People are calling me now. Hey, do you know John Fredericks? Can you get me an interview with John Fredericks from TV, from Tokyo TV to all over the world? And the reason is you're a truth teller. I think that's why the White House listens to you when you do a pretty good assessment of these press briefings, which I agree with you. I think I don't think they're helping the president. I think he's got so much other stuff to do. Kayleigh's doing a great job.
They just need to stop. Look, we need to give advice here. Sometimes it's third party. But they're a complete and utter clown show. They are now diminishing the president's authority. It's all gotcha. Like, he had a great day yesterday with a lot of good things happening. And so what hits the cycle? He has some run-in, tit-for-tat, with some Asian reporter who's there to do gotcha. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. They just need to stop. The purpose of the press conference is to give information and to advance yourself and your agenda. They give the information, he can tweet it out, and it doesn't do anything to help his agenda because it's all twisted five ways to Wednesday. It's stupid.
Well, I think that you've hit on the reason. Look, it's gotten to an antagonistic. You know, I'm the guy that came up with the opposition party concept, which still is. For whatever reason, it's just purely antagonistic. I think Kayleigh's doing a great job. Ought to put Kayleigh out there. And not every day, every couple of days when you have something to talk about.
Right.
And then the president just leads with the actions. He's the bold action he's taken, and I agree with you. They had a good day yesterday, yet the whole thing gets twisted up in kind of this gotcha back and forth, and it's just not helpful. It doesn't drive his message further. The other thing I think they have to start focusing on is stop talking about the stock market and just talk about jobs. You know, this is a jobs president. This is the manufacturing president. He knows how to build an economy. We had the lowest unemployment. The power of the economy beforehand to me wasn't the stock market, which I thought was terrific. But the stock market remembers the net present value of what people think future earnings are. And that was driven by his manufacturing policies, his industrial policy, which is really, hey, I'm a tariff country that are ripping us off. I'm rebuilding manufacturing and jobs. The key thing of his economy, it was a striver's economy. It had the first time that blue-collar workers on a percentage basis had greater growth in salary than white-collar workers. You had non-high school graduates. You had Hispanics, African-Americans, others. Really becoming into the economy and starting to have wages rise. That, to me, is our way out of here. I mean, the Sunday shows where everybody talking about the Great Depression and the shoulders are all sunk. It's like, bang, let's get on with the jobs. This is a jobs president. This guy knows how to create jobs. And that's what it's about. Not with just unleash Donald Trump to just do jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what you'll be talking about nonstop. If you do that, you're going to turn all this around. And I think get us through this, obviously, this horrific crisis.
Well, Steve Bannon, I wish you were there advising him, because he should be, instead of talking about jobs.
I got the best job. I got the best job in the world. I'm at war with the Chinese Communist Party.
Well,
nothing
that's true.
Could be better than this. So
I know, and I want to get to that in a second. But you're right. You're right, Steve, on the jobs. You're so right. Yeah, I mean, you're so spot on. You should be talking about jobs instead. You know, every day he's talking about how many tests they're doing. I mean, I get it. We need tests. I get it. Everybody wants tests. And after tests, they want COVID-19 tracers. And after that, they want something else. But he should be talking about jobs. I want to get to your position now with the CCP. You've now taken the position, based on your analysis, no, I want our audience to grasp this, that it's Steve's position that the CCP knew about this, they knew about this virus, and they were culpable in releasing it to the West so that other economies could crash. Can you elaborate on that, Steve?
Yeah, let's reset this just for a second. I think one of the powers of the John Frederick Radio Network, you know, John, you help us produce this. The Saturday show we've been doing is specials for, I think, the last 4 weeks. And these are Chinese voices talking about what it's like to live in, whether it's Wuhan, whether it's under the boot of the Chinese Communist Party in China. And last week we had four individuals from mainland China telling what it's like to live in this police state every day. It has gotten a massive attention inside of China, and they're freaking out. And the reason is the Chinese Communist Party, not the Chinese people and not the nation of China, but the Chinese Communist Party, which controls the PLA, it controls the government of China, and it controls its own party apparatus, which is really the controlling element in China. That institution has been at war with the United States through information war, cyber war, economic war for a number of years. And I think we're just now understanding this. Regardless of whether this was part of a biological weapons program, regardless if it came out of the lab, regardless if it was an inadvertent leak of something that was man-made, in other words, this he called gain-of-function experiments. Regardless of all that, which there's a massive investigation going on right now. Tom Cotton's telling you about that, the intelligence agencies. We're going to get to the bottom of that. And I think directionally it is pointing towards something to do with the Wuhan lab and something to do with these experiments. But leave all that aside for a second. The Chinese Communist Party, we now know, knew about this in late December of 2019. They knew about this from a number of sources, and she took active control of this on about January 6th or 7th. But up until then, in that last week of December, from Christmas all the way up to the 5th or 6th, they knew about human-to-human transmission and community spread, and they knew they had a massive problem in Wuhan that was about to explode. They came over here, it kept silent, came over here and signed the treaty, right, didn't let anybody know about it, talked to no one in the White House about it. Okay, at the same time, they were planning on shutting down the entire country over their Chinese New Year, which is the biggest migration in history every year. 500 million people go back to their homeland in the country. It'd be like in the United States, everybody leaving New York and D.C. and Philadelphia and going back to Virginia, going to Roanoke, going to West Virginia to go home for the holidays, right? The New Year is their big celebration. Mm-hmm. They knew they were going to shut down the country. Okay, they knew they were going to shut down Hubei, and they knew they were going to put Wuhan, which is 40% bigger than New York City, in a quarantine. They knew all this and had detailed plans to do it. At the same time, they allowed millions of Chinese who didn't know they had the disease to fly all over the world. At the same time, they went around to Europe, the United States, Brazil, and Australia and vacuumed up all the personal protective equipment, understanding that would be the key thing, the key element in stopping this pandemic in China, and also later on as the world got infected, which they knew it would, that they could use it as leverage, which they used against the United States. And so this is premeditated. It's calculated. They're culpable for it. All of the death, all of the agony, all of the economic destruction is clearly directly tied to their activity. We know because a big analysis was done by Southampton University in the United Kingdom that said that 95% of all the deaths, all the illness, all the economic carnage could have been stopped if the first week of January they had just let the world know what the truth was. They had the World Health Organization as kind of their running dog. They put out a press release on the 12th, and then again they tweeted out on the 14th, basically when we were signing the document for the Phase 1 deal, that said there's no human-to-human transmission in China, that the World Health Organization and talk to Chinese officials. Now, what we can't do is allow the World Health Organization to take our eye off the crime here. The crime is with the Chinese Communist Party and the senior members of the Chinese Communist Party. And you're seeing actions now by Tom Cotton and others to strip them of their sovereign immunity, to seize their assets, and to start going to them for reparations for what they did. And it has to happen. The Chinese Communist Party is at war with their own people. They're at war with the United States. They're at war with mankind. They have to be held accountable. And this would, what upsets me is that we turned on each other in this country, saying, hey, this governor, this mayor is either shutting down things too much or opening up things too quickly. They're either overcompensating for this or not doing enough. We're at each other's throats. The enemy is the Chinese Communist Party. That's who did this to America. They did it to the people in China. They never allowed Wuhan. They never gave Wuhan a heads up. All of the deaths there, and those deaths are the hundreds and hundreds of thousands. They have a city the size of, almost the size of Wuhan, called Harbin, up near the Russian border in Manchuria. That is now in lockdown and quarantine like Wuhan was, but they will not let the media near it. So these are bad actors. They're totally evil. They've destroyed their own people. They've destroyed their own country. They've broken their countrymen. And if you want to hear the stories of the Chinese people, just tune in every Saturday and go back to our podcast. We'll get them back up for you today, John. It is heart-rending to hear the story of these people of how a totalitarian dictatorship have destroyed them, and now they've destroyed the world.
The people that you get out from the mainland, Steve, that called into your show, and I've, of course I hear it every Saturday, how do they get away with doing that without getting, you know, tracked down? Because the Chinese, they trace everything. How do they stay out of harm's way?
Our co-producing partner on this is Miles Grohl, the whistleblower.
Yeah.
It's very sophisticated. It's a reason every day on the John Fresh Radio Network, we take that show and actually subtitles it in Mandarin every day, blows it through the firewall to the VPNs, and then people, millions of people, tens of millions of people watch the show every day because the feedback we get is just enormous. These guys are professionals at doing this, and people do this at huge risk themselves. There's already a number, people should know there's a number of whistleblowers already about what's going on in those labs, about what's going on in these other areas. That's all going to come out over the next weeks and months. But they have a very, listen, the Chinese people hate the Chinese Communist Party. Of 1.4 people, there's only 90 million communists. And of the 90 million communists, only really 1,000 matter. Mm-hmm. And of that, 12 families run the whole thing. The leader, Xi and Wang Qishan, the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party are among the wealthiest people in the world. This is one of the things we're arguing here in the United States. The reason I'm public enemy number one in China by the Chinese Communist Party is very simple. We're the first show of consistently to separate out the crimes of the Chinese Communist Party from the innocent victims of the Chinese people
right.
in the state of China. It's not the Chinese. We don't have a beef with the Chinese people. We have a beef. We have a problem, and we're at war. They're at war with us, with the Chinese Communist Party. That's what we have to keep the focus on, and they hate it. No one's ever done that before. Number two, I go there and say, hey, guess what? These are the wealthiest guys in the world. We have to seize their assets, whether it's in Belgravia in West London or whether it's in Midtown Manhattan. These people have hundreds of billions of dollars they've stolen from the Chinese people who live like slaves. And what they've done, they kept it for themselves. And essentially that wealth came from the American people, came from the people that the factories went to China. The Chinese Communist Party basically control it. They're in charge. This is pure evil. You know, President Trump went out of his way to try to make a deal, to try to work with them. And all they did was give him the back of their hand, lied to him consistently. And this just can't go on like this. The American people have never, ever, ever had an enemy that confronted them like this. And now it's mocking them and laughing in their face. They have to be confronted. If they're not confronted and taken down, the world's going to be a very different place.
Let me read a text here from a Democratic listener in Richmond, Rufus, who says, I've listened to almost every War Room pandemic program since March 13th. I believe Steve and his crew are 100% correct. People should listen to his nonpartisan reporting on this subject, Rufus the Democrat in Richmond. So, Steve, you're reaching people. It doesn't matter what their persuasion is.
I want to thank Rufus and thank Democrats. Look, there's no harder partisans than Jason Miller, Steve Bannon, Jack Maxey, and Raheem Kassam. However, we go out of our way. We had Bob Kuttner on yesterday, the progressive economist, talking about manufacturing jobs. We go out of our way to try to be even-handed. We had an Obama delegate to the 2012 Democratic Convention emailed us yesterday or tweeted to us. We read it online. He's listened to every show. They've listened to every show. And they said, this is where the truth is coming out about what we as Americans, not as Democrats or Republicans, but we as Americans have to confront, have to face the fact the Chinese Communist Party has destroyed their own people and now have turned to try to destroy the Western world. And so this is, it really gives us confidence that we're getting the message out to those Democrats that are open-minded enough to listen to this, although it comes from, we're very partisan. But we try to present this information that we have to put our partisanship aside. We have to put the Republican and Democrat stuff aside. We have to put whether you're a Biden supporter or Trump supporter, and you have to face this.
All right, got another text here I want to read you from Barry, a caller in Weirs Cave, Virginia. He says, I listen to Steve's show every day. It's great analysis. Can you ask Steve if he thinks Dr. Fauci will be questioned about the NIH involvement with the lab in Wuhan when he testifies today in the Senate hearing?
Absolutely. This is what I love about doing the show and about your audience. They get it. That is the more sophisticated question than you heard on Morning Joe this morning. He should. It's a Republican. Remember, the good news about having it at the Senate is that we control it, right? You know, the Republicans can actually control the panel. Those questions have to be asked. We're going to be coming up with a lot more analysis on that very topic of NIH's involvement in what are called gain-of-function experiments, what Fauci did, so remember, we attack Fauci every day, but it's not the traditional attack from the right that, oh, he knows Hillary Clinton, he winks at Jonathan Carl, he knows Bill Gates. We go at him for he's not consistent enough in the advice he gives the president. The metrics move all over the place. We want Dr. Fauci to be more of a scientist. And that's what we're going to drill down now with Dr. Fauci, NIH, and other involvement in all these experiments throughout the world, and particularly what involvement they've had with the Chinese Communist Party, and particularly what they were doing with funding things around Wuhan with American taxpayer dollars. So that's a brilliant question. I hope it gets asked today. It should. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Fauci, look, people should understand, on the show today, it's going to be live at the same time of his testimony. At the same time, the president, this massive case in the Supreme Court about presidential power and presidential prerogatives is being argued. Today's a huge day to turn the show. Fauci is going to make a case, and I know this is particularly sensitive to you, John, who have kind of been, I think, the guy that's argued the other side of the case.
Yeah.
Is that Fauci is going to say, hey, if you open up and you haven't totally thought these things through, you're going to bring on potentially a bigger second wave. And I think that goes a little bit counter to what the president's been putting out. And what I don't understand is how, in the administration, his chief guy in this task force is coming out with really, it looks like, and we haven't heard the testimony. We've seen some things that have been leaked. But, you know, it's like it's counter to what the president's been laying out. So I think it's a very big day. Fauci's testimony is going to be big. And I hope, like your caller said, that the Republicans start to ask him the tough questions here. What his involvement's been.
Well, they need to fire his ass because, I mean, the guy gets off on TV and pops off. Every time the president says something, he runs over to CNN and disputes what he says. This guy is a Hillary Clinton bureaucrat, been there forever. And when they talk about surges, I just keep asking for metrics. We were sold on shutting down the greatest economy in the history of the world and putting 35 million people out of work and destroying millions and millions of lives and small businesses to not overrun the hospital system. We have not done that. Not overrun the beds. We've not done that. Not overrun ventilators. We've not done that. Flatten the curve. We've done that. Now, Steve, my position is it's all politics now because we've done all that. And as long as they can keep this closed and they can destroy small businesses who are the bane of the DNC. They hate small businesses because small business owners are capitalists. They're entrepreneurs. The DNC can't control them. They don't want the government's money. They hate them. They want to destroy them. And then we can get the mail-in ballots like they did in California, and then they win, and then they have power. It defies all logic.
I agree with you. I agree with you on one important point here is that I think Fauci, I've said this for a while, he and Birx have to come out. They have to start putting out some models and metrics about what is success, what are the objectives. And this is one of the reasons
I think
the response sometimes hasn't been as laser-focused. The other thing is I think that if Mnuchin and Jared are going to continue to talk about that the economy is going to be rocking in July, let's get the metrics out. What models are you looking at? Your audience, no matter what their job is, everybody's fairly sophisticated now looking at models, looking at financials. People know that this is how you plan, whether it's a you have a lawn business or whether you're in the radio business or whatever you're on. Everybody understands they have to have some grasp on the future and how that mathematically lays out. I think it's incumbent on the administration more than ever. And this is my problem with Fauci. Fauci moves the goalpost every day. And I don't know what he tells the president behind closed doors. I don't know what he talks about on his task force. But to your point, when the president says something, Dr. Fauci is normally on CNN a couple hours later exactly saying the exact opposite or enough of difference that you say, well, how can this be consistent? I think that's my problem with him. I don't care that he knows Hillary Clinton. I don't care that he's Bill Gates, all that. Here's what I care about. What's the advice he's given the president? And is it consistent to a set of metrics that these plans that people are putting in that he's been right or he hasn't been right? To me, so far, he's been way off. And I think that that's a problem. And I think that accountability, you know, obviously the voters are going to hold everybody accountable in November. They're going to hold the governors. They're going to hold people in the House and Senate. They're going to hold the administration. Because like I say, every day is November 3rd. And I think people are being weighed and measured right now. That's why I think consistency and constancy are things that the White House, you know, when President Trump's made bold moves, great things have happened. And those bold moves have clearly been off, whether it's Navarro's report or this analysis that people did on the European shutdown. It led the president taking bold action that helped the country and helped his presidency.
Well, Steve, you're exactly right. We need modeling and metrics because they say, you know, you just said the president needs to be talking about jobs. You can't be talking about jobs if you don't let businesses open and people go back to work. There are no jobs. You've got Pelosi now talking about a $2,000 a month basic income. Remember, Andrew Yang was talking about this on the debates and people made fun of him. And now you've got the speaker doubling.
Andrew Yang got, what, 1% of the
vote? He got 1% of the vote.
Mr. Yang got a lot of publicity, but was really an afterthought when it came to votes. Hey, here's what Pelosi's going to lay out. And I've said this for a while. She's coming out this week or next week when they vote. It's going to be three-pronged. You're going to have universal basic income. You're going to have a single payer. And you're going to have Green New Deal. They're going to roll up the big trifecta and lay it out there and say, hey, we're here to help the American people. And Mitch McConnell and the Scrooges in the United States Senate are going to put people on the breadline. So, unfortunately, the politics here is going to start to get ramped up in the next couple of weeks, and we're just going to have to go through these things. I think Pelosi is going to look at this as an opportunity to jam in a massive program in this phase four, and we're going to have to, you know, people are going to have to deal with this.
Define that. Define what you mean by dealing with it.
Well, I think that here's the point. Has PPP worked? I mean, you're the best judge of this. Has PPP worked? This is not a stimulus. This is just a bridge over a chasm until we start opening back up. Has PPP and these other ability to get money to workers, has it worked well enough that it can actually bridge the gap until businesses start opening up in June and July?
It can get businesses through, as we've said from the beginning, a lot of businesses, it can get them through the third week in May. But the other problem we have now is businesses that are trying to open in Atlanta can't find workers. I found the same thing in Tennessee. They can't find workers because they're making $25 an hour on unemployment. The workers want to stay home and get the $25 an hour, $1,000 a week until July 31st. And the businesses don't want to rat them out because they eventually want to get them back. So those are a couple of the dilemmas. But, like, we can deal with the unemployment. We just got to open this economy up, Steve. Businesses got to get open. When I was in Tennessee, if you want any evidence that this whole thing is politics, you got four Democratic mayors in Tennessee, Nashville, Memphis, Chattanooga, and Knoxville. All four mayors shut their cities down. The Republican legislator and the governor opened up Tennessee. So you're open for business, except for those four cities that the mayors have the power to overrule. So I'm staying in Nashville. I want to go to dinner with a friend of mine. We have to sneak over the county line 4 miles away. We get 100 yards out of Davidson County. I go to dinner. There's 100 people there. I have to sneak back into Nashville. I mean, it's absurd what is going on. But that's the politics of it, Stephen. It's only going to get worse.
Yeah, I think we're in for a very tough summer and fall. But hey, the American people are tough, and we're just gonna have to pound through this.
All right,
one thing I think we can all hope for, and coming through this, this dilemma is that hopefully we won't have to see too many more of John Frederick's workout videos tweeted out. So.
Talk Radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Greg Clugston in Washington. The White House is criticizing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's early response to the coronavirus outbreak. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, the president's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, said the CDC let the country down after initial delays with testing. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says all people in his state with flu-like symptoms are now eligible for COVID-19 tests, and Los Angeles is providing those tests to anyone, regardless of whether they have symptoms. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new government has been sworn in. The Israeli parliament, the Knesset, passed a vote of confidence today in Netanyahu's new administration after three deadlocked elections. In NASCAR's first race in 10 weeks, Kevin Harvick took the checkered flag at Darlington Raceway. This is SRN News.
Let's welcome Jeremy Camp.
Hope comes home with I Still Believe. You can download it now at WatchSalemMedia.com. From the creators of I Can Only Imagine comes the uplifting true life story of Christian music megastar Jeremy Camp.
I'm supposed to be with her. I can't explain it. I just know that.
Jeremy's hope and faith are put to the test when tragedy strikes.
You're going to be healed.
What if I'm not supposed to be healed?
Don't say that.
I Still Believe is an incredible story of musical stardom, the heights of love, the depths of loss, and the healing power of the human spirit. One love can change your life.
You chose willingly to walk into the fire with her. That's what love is.
Witness the true story of Christian music star Jeremy Camp and his journey of love and loss that looks to prove there is always hope. Starring KJ Apa, Britt Robertson, Gary Sinise, and Shania Twain. Own I Still Believe on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital now from Lionsgate at WatchSalemMedia.com. That's WatchSalemMedia.com.
How will the weather affect you? WBOB weather.
Mostly sunny today, looking for a high of 86, partly cloudy tonight, down to 68, and then a 60% chance of rain for Monday, mostly sunny, highs of 88. 40% chance of rain Monday night through about the rest of the week, with mostly sunny days, highs into the upper 80s, partly cloudy at night, low near 70.
This year marks the 63rd anniversary of Boger Shoes on Park Street here in Jacksonville. In order for a family business to celebrate 63 years, they must be doing something right. And that something is good old-fashioned customer service. For 63 years, Boger Shoes has been providing orthopedic and diabetic shoes for thousands of customers in Northeast Florida. During the month of May, Bogers would like to show their appreciation for all our area nurses all month long. Nurses can purchase Dance Go clogs, buy one, get one half off. And through May 6th through May 12th, all nurses can receive an additional 10% off. Plus, there is free shipping through May 31st. Boger Shoes is taking the coronavirus and your safety very seriously. For your protection, Boger staff and seat beds will be wearing gloves and masks while serving you. Boger's thoughts and prayers are with their customers and community during this difficult time. Boger Shoes, the answer for hurting feet.
Why pay big city prices? Hi, I'm Jamie Smith. Take the scenic route that leads to Atlantic Auto Brokers on Amelia Island. We are a boutique auto shop with a great selection. What sets us apart is if we don't have the car you're looking for, I'll get it for you. Atlantic Auto Brokers stands behind our cars and offers on-site financing and service. Check us out online at AtlanticAutoBrokerSE.com. So take the short drive and spend a day with us on beautiful Amelia Island, where I'll save you a bunch or I'll buy you lunch.
Follow John Fredericks at JF Radio Show.
John Fredericks Radio Network joining us now on the John Fredericks Radio Show. Nick Freitas, Nick, House of Delegates member of Virginia, Culpepper, and he's a leading candidate for Congress District 7 to take on as the Republican nominee Abigail Spanberger in November, and he's with us now. Nick, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, John.
All right, Nick, let's start with a little political business. And just as a complete disclaimer, I personally endorsed Nick Freitas for Congress. I think he'd be the best candidate other candidates, all nice people. I think Freitas can win. That's why I did that. So just a disclaimer there. Nick, let's get to your convention. When is it? How does it work? What's going on? Give us an update.
So right now it's looking like they might be trying to hold a physical convention on July 18th. I think the 7th District still has to vote on that, but I know that's one of the options. And they've also looked at some potential alternatives like a drive-through convention and some things like that if we weren't able to hold a physical convention where we could all be in the same location. But I know that July 18th is one of the dates they're looking at potentially holding it.
Nick, what would allow that to happen? Like, what would Governor Northam have to do by July 17th to allow that to happen?
Well, obviously, we'd have to be returning to, you know, some degree of normalcy here, where you would be allowed to have large-scale events in a location with multiple people attending. That's what would be required at this point.
I mean, do you see the guy won't even open up Virginia Beach? He won't open a restaurant up, putting hundreds and thousands of small businesses out into bankruptcy. I mean, if he doesn't open up Virginia Beach, that entire strip is gone. I mean, a lot of those people I know, their business depends on the summer. You wipe out the summer, they're in bankruptcy on the unemployment line. Do you actually see him doing that?
I really don't know. A lot can happen in 2 months, which is that's about the length of time between now and July 18th. A lot can happen within that time. We'll see what happens. I think a lot of people are getting very, very frustrated by the governor's management, and we'll just have to see.
Your committee is going to vote on the date, but then that's going to be determined on whether or not the government allows the gathering.
That's correct.
Right. So you vote on the date, you go from there, basically. Is that the way I understand it?
All right, seventh district committee.
In a convention now, all the delegate filings are in, right? I mean, that's done. You've either got the delegates or you don't. All those are closed. How do you guys look there, Nick?
We look very good. We're very confident about where we are in relation to the other candidates, and I think we will do very well at a convention.
So you're in good shape there. Now, let's get to the governor's response here. On May 15th, some businesses can open, but a lot of rules, like if you're a hair salon, you have to put appointments in your appointment book. You can't allow walk-ins, and restaurants still can't open. Bars can't open. Theaters can't open. Movie theaters can't. Bowling alleys, no. No nail salons. But there's certain things you are nail salons, I'm not sure. But there's certain things you can do. You can eat outside. Where is he going with this?
Well, I think that's been part of the problem since this happened. I think when the governor first started putting in these restrictions, everybody was willing to give him a degree of latitude, but I think that patience is over at this point. And I think when you look at the sort of restrictions that he's coming up with now, instead of it's the typical government problem, right? You're trying to achieve a particular end state, and instead of the government saying, look, this is the end state, this is what we want to achieve, now private sector go out there and find new, innovative, and creative ways in order to conduct business, the government's trying to micromanage the process. And let's just take theaters, for instance. I mean, we've all been to a movie theater. You don't think there's a way that they could operate where they could have people go into a movie theater, maintain certain distances, and that are maintained at every other business, whether it's ABC stores or other things that are allowed to be open. That's the problem that I have with it, is telling a salon you can't have walk-ins. Well, okay, here's my question. If they're able to operate in a way that it would maintain the same safety standards that you get if they have a scheduled appointment, why wouldn't they be allowed to do that? We don't need to micromanage individual processes. You can tell the private sector, here's the guidelines that we're looking to achieve, but we don't need to be in there on the details with everything. If it's about maintaining social distancing, if it's about wearing PPE, okay, those are all things that might be good guidelines, but allow those businesses to come up with creative ways to do it. Don't try to micromanage the process. And that's the problem that we've had with the governor. I think him coming out and saying that, well, we're not going to do this regionally, it has to be all or nothing for Virginia, is ridiculous. It treats every single county in Virginia as if it's exactly the same. And obviously, Alexandria, Fairfax, Richmond, these are all areas that are going to have to deal with this differently than a Culpeper, an Amelia, an Ottaway, a Lee County. And so by not even relaxing some of it to say let's let localities come up with certain guidelines, I think is absurd.
So you've got, if you look at a map, or researcher Den Black provided this with, if you look at a map in Virginia, there's a host of counties without any deaths at all. None. Zero. So why can't they just go back to regular order?
Well, I think this is the problem. When President Trump was looking at guidelines, he didn't say the entire country has to operate exact same way. He said, look, once we've met certain thresholds, allow people to open up. But ultimately, we have a federalized system for a reason. And it's because we recognize that we can't micromanage the entire country from Washington, D.C. Well, just like we can't do that from Washington, D.C. for the entire country, we shouldn't be trying to micromanage the entire Commonwealth from Richmond. But again, some of this, I mean, when you have a political philosophy which rests on the idea that the government's got to have control and we've got to be controlling things from a few people in a centralized location, you know, that's how they operate. That's how they attempt to operate when there isn't a crisis. And clearly when there is one, they just dial that up to 11. And it's really frustrating to watch.
You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network live in Virginia. We are with Nick Freitas, candidate for Congress, 7th District. That Republican nominee will be determined right now at a convention sometime over the summer. The date hasn't been set. The convention hasn't been allowed yet. It's all in flux. But if he is, he would go against Abigail Spermberger. Let me ask you, Nick, you've been fighting for civil liberties since I've met you. That's been your reputation. So before we get into Spermberger, let me just ask you a couple things. Have you been surprised at the country's willingness to forego their basic civil liberties guaranteed in the Constitution in order to follow these governor's edicts?
Yeah, I have. I think that, again, initially everybody was willing to give a great deal of latitude, but unfortunately you see with Governor Northam, and I mean, he was rated as an F by the Wall Street Journal. You see what's going on in Michigan. I think we're getting to a point right now where, again, I'm concerned that people are willing to give the government way too much latitude with respect to handling the crisis. And ultimately, the Constitution was not just written for nice, you know, sunny days. The Constitution was written for whatever circumstances that we find ourselves in. And it's important for elected officials to understand that they don't get to just arbitrarily suspend rights indefinitely. And I think you're seeing more and more pushback, and we've got some great organizations here in Virginia and whatnot that are stepping up and saying, wait a second, you cannot get away with this. Constitutionally, this is not permitted. And you've seen some cases now where Governor Northam has lost, whether it was with a gun range, whether it was with a pastor that he was threatening to put in jail for a year. And again, these organizations were not doing something that was inherently dangerous. They were finding ways to operate that met safety standards, but the government had decided that they weren't allowed to operate, and people are starting to push back now. And you know, unfortunately, I wish it didn't require civil disobedience sometimes to push back against government overreach, but when you see the government operating in such a way, again, threatening a pastor who was having an event where everybody was able to maintain social distancing, everybody was able to, you know, have PPE and to operate in a safe manner, To threaten them with jail time at the same time that the same governor says that abortion clinics can operate freely, that the ABC stores, which are run by the government, they can operate because they want to make sure they continue to get the tax revenue. That's the part that people are I think, rebelling against at this point. And again, I think we need the governor to understand that he has an obligation to protect civil liberties at all times. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do so in a safe manner. Mm-hmm. You know, I think American people are inherently reasonable. But once you start engaging in this kind of overreach, don't expect them to just sit there and comply indefinitely with the edicts coming out of Richmond.
Well, it's been incredible to me to see the level of submission and compliance. Let's get to these contact tracers. The governor says he's going to hire 1,000 contact tracers paid for by tax dollars, so you and I are going to be paying for it. And what these contact tracers do is, let's say somebody goes in the doctors and they test positive for COVID-19, then they have to give everybody they've come in contact with the next, I don't know, the last month they can remember, they get their names and addresses. So if somebody's walking their dog and they have it and I'm walking by and I talk to them for a minute, then I get on the list, then they come to my home, then I can't go out for 14 days. And then they come and check at different times every day to be sure I'm home. And if I'm not home, I have to have papers as to why I'm out. But no, I can't be out at all now. And so I'll get a fine. And the second time, I'll get put in jail because now the jails are open because they're letting criminals out. What the hell is this about?
Oh, no, it's absurd. It's absurd. I don't think it's enforceable. I don't think people are going to stand for it. And like you said, I think you brought up a really good point as well. They're threatening the popular. They're threatening law-abiding citizens with these new restrictions and new rules. At the same time, and some of those threats come with potential jail time or other fines and fees. At the same time that they're fighting to release people that are already in jail, they released a cop killer the other day without even telling the family. So again, it's absurdity. This is the problem when the government tries to micromanage something. Put out guidelines, put out good information, do your job, which is to allocate resources, and, you know, resources that the government has in order to combat the threat. Send resources to areas where you have concentrated breakouts so that you can nip it in the bud. But my gosh, this idea of tracking people, and then okay, what's the penalty if I forget that I talked to somebody a week ago because it was a brief conversation or I was just walking by them on the road? What, am I in trouble now? You know, these are the sort of problems that you get into. And I don't think people are going to stand for it. And I ultimately, I don't think it creates a good situation for either health concerns, security concerns, or concerns over civil liberties.
And we have the pleasure of paying for our own persecution. That's the irony of this. Well, you have to pay to be persecuted. It's the most insane thing.
Yeah, well, the government's also learning right now that, you know, there's always been this idea, and we've seen this in a couple areas where businesses were forced to shut down, but then they were getting notices that if they didn't pay their taxes, that they were going to face legal action. And you know, we constantly have the fight down in Richmond. We had it down this session about fleecing taxpayers at every stop. And now some of my Democrat colleagues are starting to understand that, gosh, it's really hard to fleece taxpayers when you don't allow them to make money in the first place.
Unbelievable.
And this is the problem. Right? There are people out there that honestly believe that the government comes first, right? The government has, you know, power and authorities, and they're going to execute those authorities. Well, no. You know, again, Reagan said it best, right? We are a people with a government, not a government with a people. And there's some very moral connotations to that, but there's also practical considerations as well. And this idea that the government would attempt to continue to fleece businesses, fleece taxpayers. Well, okay, you got nothing to fleece if you're not actually allowing them to engage in commerce.
Unbelievable. We're with Nick Freitas running for Congress in the 7th District. One more question, then I'm going to get to Spamberger, but I just got to ask you this. You're in the House of Delegates. Did you realize under the Emergency Powers Act, which is like one paragraph buried somewhere, did you guys know how much power a governor had?
So, yeah, it's way too open-ended, and it's something that I've actually fought back before about this idea of civil liberties in a time of crisis and government's powers. And so I think it's something that we're going to go back and I mean, I know I'm certainly interested in the General Assembly revising what sort of powers the government has in an emergency crisis. But no, it's something I've been concerned with. And again, here's the problem. How do you write that so specifically that a governor doesn't go beyond their authority? And I think that you use the Constitution as a guide. You use basic civil liberties as a guide. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people that believe that in a time of crisis, the government should essentially just take everything over. And quite frankly, some of those people want the government to take everything over when we don't have a crisis. And so this fits into their political philosophy rather nicely. But I think that what I'm hoping for is that people are actually going to have more of an appetite to rein in government power after experiencing what we're going through right now.
Well, I should hope so. Right now, the polls are not reflecting that. And as the Speaker of the House in Georgia said to me when I was there 2 weeks ago, people are getting a taste of socialism, and some people really like sitting home in their pajamas and getting money wired into their bank account. They like it. So hey, this isn't so bad. All right, Nick, I want to get the statement you made the other day. You slammed Democrat Congresswoman 7th District Abigail Spanberger. You said, look, she's actively campaigning for Biden. She refuses to address the Tara Reid sexual assault allegation, yet she believed Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And so you said this is the height of hypocrisy. You want to elaborate on that?
Sure. I think whenever somebody comes forward with a sexual assault claim, they should be taken seriously. And law enforcement should do everything they can to investigate that in order to make sure that if something has taken place, that the appropriate parties are punished. But you always treat the allegation seriously, and you treat the person bringing forward the allegation with respect, but then you also provide due process of law. That's always been the standard that I've applied to this. The problem is that's not the standard Democrats apply to this. Democrats have used this as a political tool, and that's my problem, because I feel like they're undermining the entire process. And Joe Biden was big on this. Abby L. Spanberger was big on this. They created a standard, and now they don't want to live by the standard. And my again, that's the hypocrisy involved in this entire case, is that if your standard is believe all women, if your standard is that when somebody's accused of something like this, that's the end of their political career, well, then you have to apply that standard equally, or it's not a standard.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that we're going to get to a point where, again, when somebody feels like they have, or when somebody has been the victim of sexual assault, I want them to feel absolutely confident in their ability to come forward, be treated with respect, be treated with dignity, have an investigation, due process of law, and then if somebody is guilty, then they are prosecuted appropriately. That should be the standard. But unfortunately, the Democrats have chosen that there's one standard for them and their party, and there's a different standard for everybody else. And when you do something like that, what you're essentially saying is there is no standard. And that's my problem, is that I feel like it undermines this entire process. And again, I'm not surprised anymore. Abigail Spanberger has made a lot of claims when she was running for office the first time. She was a moderate. She was middle of the road. She was a problem solver. She wasn't a partisan. Well, now you're voting with Nancy Pelosi 96% of the time. You vote for impeachment, even though there was nowhere near the evidence to justify it. And now you're giving a pass to your own political party when there's sexual assault allegations. So, okay, show me how you're doing anything that you promised the voters you would do when you were running and, quite frankly, mocking David Brett. And so I think the people are going to see through this, and I think they're going to, again, they're going to see the hypocrisy, and they're going to reject it in November.
So here's what Spanberger said during the Kavanaugh confirmation process. She said, this is a direct quote, "Watching the testimony of Dr. Ford, I'm impressed by her strength and poise and saddened by the pain her questioning is causing so many survivors of sexual assault." That was Spanberger in September of 2018. The Spanberger in 2020 completely rejects Tara Reid, blows her off. I guess she's not impressed by her poise. She's not saddened by her pain. And she doesn't care about her sexual assault, even though she's got people that she told about it immediately. And Dr. Ford couldn't remember where she was, when that happened, who was there, didn't tell anybody. And it was double the time ago. So Ford had no memory of anything, told no one. Tara Reid, on the other hand, told a bunch of people the next day and knew exactly where it was, what day it was, what time it was, and exactly what hall she was in. What's the deal? Why not just come clean here?
Well, it's simple, because she's endorsed Joe Biden, because she's actively campaigning with him. They're doing a town hall together to talk about health care. So that's the difference. One had a D by their name, and one they considered was a conservative. And if it's a conservative, well, then the standard that they've created applies. And if it's a Democrat, they want to pass. And you don't get to do that. If that's the standard you're going to apply, then you apply it to everyone equally. But, you know, look, Spanberger understands. She's getting a lot of money from Nancy Pelosi's PAC. She wants to get a lot of money from the Biden campaign. She's not going to be able to do those things if she wants to apply the same standard to Biden that she applied to Kavanaugh. And I'm sorry, unless she wants to come out and actually explain what the difference is, because as you just articulated, by any measure that we actually look at the sort of evidence and testimony, we would say that there's a much stronger case against Biden. But again, nothing. She's actively campaigning with Joe Biden right now amidst all of this. She hasn't, you know, asked for Joe Biden to come clean with anything. She hasn't asked for, you know, for his accuser to get a fair shot or her day in the court of either public opinion or a court of law. She hasn't done any of that. And so what's the difference? The difference is Joe Biden is her candidate.
Exactly. So it's the height of hypocrisy. These people stand for nothing. Spanberger lied when she, you know, whined about Ford, lied when she ran. I mean, basically she says she was a moderate. She was going to work with the president. She didn't do any of that stuff. Now she's just a slave to AOC and Pelosi and Schumer and the whole wing of the party. And, of course, she's for, you know, mail-in ballots now.
John, real quick. Elizabeth Warren has a more bipartisan voting record than Abigail Spanberger.
What's that tell you? Right? All right, final thing. Only got a minute. What are the changes in voting in November, right? That got signed into law starting in July, so it isn't going to affect the primary. What's the voting changes in Virginia come November that was passed by the Democrats and signed by the governor?
So the different voting issues that took place within the General Assembly session, it got rid of voter ID. It allowed for same-day voter registration. Those two things right there are, I think, really bad policy when it comes to integrity of elections. There's two things that we're always fighting for: access to elections and integrity of elections. So we want as many people that can legally vote to vote. And then we want people, and then we want those elections to be open, honest, transparent. We don't want there to be a lot of things within the code that allows for gamesmanship or fraud. And unfortunately, you know, the two things that I think actually kind of helped with voter integrity and the integrity of our elections was photo ID. And you had to register to vote. You couldn't register the same day. You couldn't walk into a polling location where they don't have any of the equipment really to you know, validate that, yeah, you're legally present in the United States and allowed to vote in a particular district. They wanted to take all that away. And so, yeah, that's very problematic. The other thing that they did, which was incredibly bad, was during the veto session, the governor put an amendment in the budget where he basically moved a lot of the local elections that were supposed to take place in June to November. And what was so bad about that, and the bad precedent about that, was that, one, there were thousands of absentee ballots that had already been cast. They just threw them out. And they said, well, you'll get a chance to vote in November. Not only that, but the term that those elected officials are serving, whether it's on your board of supervisors, your town council, that term is over. And now all of a sudden they just got, 4 months added onto their term just by government fiat? I mean, think about that. I want you to think, what would Democrats' reaction be if Donald Trump came out and said, you know what, it's just too dangerous to have an election in November, and so I'm just going to be president for the next 4 to 5 months until we have a safer time to do it. Democrats would lose their minds, and rightfully so. But when they've decided to do with these local elections, I guess it's okay now. In fact, we were even accused that if we didn't agree with this, we were racist, right? Because that's what we're always accused of whenever we have a problem with a particular Democrat policy position. So as I look at this going forward and I see that the Democrats, they wanted to move to remote voting for the House of Delegates. They needed 2/3 majority in order to do that. Thankfully, every single Republican voted against remote voting, because that's ridiculous to allow delegates to sit in their house somewhere and cast votes. So, no, there's been a whole slew of things that I think really hurt the integrity of our elections. And again, I can't say I don't understand why they want to do it, but I certainly don't understand why the American people or the people of Virginia would ever put up with what they're trying to do.
Well, elections have consequences, Nick, and we got our head handed to us in 17 and 19. Caucus of the Corn took over. Saslaw the Godfather took over. You have a Democratic governor. They're going to continue to manipulate the voting process in order to ensure power and victory, just like they're doing with this COVID-19. The goal is mail-in ballots, and the ultimate objective is to elect Joe Biden. As soon as we do that, there'll be an all clear. There'll be an immediate vaccine that somebody will come up with. All the models will be different. All the numbers will change. Nick, that's what the objective is. If they can manipulate the balloting system, they can gain power and keep it in perpetuity. That's their goal. Damn the torpedoes, straight ahead. Certainly, as you pointed out, Spamberger with the Tara Reid thing is totally hypocritical. Nick, I'm way over my time. Thank you for being with us. People want more info. Where do they go?
They go to nick4va.com. Also, follow us on Facebook. We've also got a podcast called Making the Argument, so there's a lot of different mechanisms to stay in touch with the campaign and what we're doing.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show, Common Sense for the Commonwealth, on great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.